Thank you, Dave, very much. Thank you. The ploy worked, and sneaking the S word into a Blackboard talk at the ITP pulls them in. So it's a complete sham, of course, but, well, no, it is not, it's not. So it worked, but I did tell you the truth. These are not going to be relativistic strings, they're not going to be tensions at the Planck length, they're going to be tensions the Planck tension is going to be tensions rather smaller than that. But strings nonetheless, and I thought our job perhaps is to describe to the audience here in general, at the ITP, what these crazy complex fluids people have been doing the last couple of weeks. You've heard from us from time to time over the course of the five-month program, but you may have noticed some raised voices, a little bit more activity than usual over the last couple of weeks, and some people with sweat running off their brow. So what's all this been happening? Why has that all been happening? And it's to do with strings. So, you know, we all get tied up in knots over these issues. Why strings? And why strings in the context of a complex fluid physics? Well, just a few examples. So let's just start with the most common ones, and that's the physics related to material science, to the materials, the synthetic polymeric materials that have been known for a good half century or more, more now, like polyethylene. So you know what happens: you make giant molecules out of polymerizing small molecules, ethylene, and these become huge long strings due to the fact that the extraordinarily surprising stability of long chains of carbon atoms. Now, I hope you'll allow me to proceed at this point. There's a famous occasion where one of our number, as a research student, was giving a research seminar in the physics department at Caltech, and he got to about this point in the hour, setting it in context that polymer physics arose out of chemistry, when he was interrupted from a theoretician on the back row who, with an enormously weighty reputation, he said, "Hang on, do you really suggest that molecules of string-like molecules with greater than 5 or 6 carbon atoms in a row are going to be stable? Nah, one-dimensional, you know, no phase transitions, blah, blah, eventual instability. Can't possibly be true." And a party of them got up and left. Please hang on in there. It's called polyethylene. This is what you walk home with your groceries in. It's an extraordinary material, and these things are stable for a very long time. Okay, so, but this is chemistry, okay? And the cocktail parties that I go to, how about you? When you're asked what you do and you say you're a physicist, and then okay, if the conversation doesn't die at this point, it might usually does. But now we're on to sort of epsilon of that fraction. What do you do next? What do you do? Well, I'm interested in polymers, plastic. Oh, I thought that was chemistry. So the next thing to explain is why there's physics in this, and not just complex things about covalent bonds. And it's physics for the usual reason. So I'd just like to spend the first little part putting in context why polymeric molecules might be very familiar to a physicist or to an end of 20th century physicist who is familiar with emergent phenomena, renormalization, phase transitions, the whole gamut, the whole field theoretic language of quantum field theory and statistical mechanics that's been a great gift, the wonderful toolboxes and conceptual treasure chests which we've had given to us by the last century. Well, why might physics be interested in this? Well, it's simply because of size. And I've drawn a few carbons, but the number of atoms in one of these chains in a typical polymer, polystyrene is like this, but it has a ring off the side, don't run to the tens or hundreds, but to the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. Okay. So we have to take a step back and look at this thing from the other side of the car park. Right? And when we do that, you can't actually resolve the carbon atoms in the width of my piece of chalk. What's more, any residual stiffness that might have existed between one bond and the next disappears. And from one chunk of this polymer to the next, the little step that I take has an orientation which is completely uncorrelated from the last one. So I can coarse grain this random walk, as it is, into large pieces completely uncorrelated with themselves. Well, I could take another step back, you see, and make this a piece of a much larger random walk, which has another copy of this thing hanging over here, and this could be a step in the much larger random walk, and so forth. So by rescaling a problem that is locally dependent on high-frequency cutoffs, otherwise known as chemistry, we get to a problem which is universal. So how are we going to deal with this problem of universal propagator? Here's the universal polymer. They're just beads, and they could be anything, right? What's more, they're floating about in some sort of solution. So it's a statistical mechanical system. It's random, it's Brownian, it's stochastic. Well, I can get some sort of handle on this by asking probabilistic questions. Okay, we don't know the state of the object, just any more than in quantum mechanics we want to know about a particular state or outcome. We want to know the amplitude distribution. That there's this deep similarity that pops up between quantum field theory and statistical mechanics all the way, but of course isn't by any means exact, but I want to exhibit one way of seeing how some of the structure maps. Let's just suppose we have a chain of n links, and we know it starts off over here, and we want a probability that this thing propagates over here. If we know that object, so if we know how likely we are to find another piece of a polymer at a known position r, given how many links we have in the chain, we can do quite a few things with that. We could derive free energies. We could calculate the entropy. We could do we could average over ensembles. Now let's see what this thing. If we can write down an equation for this object. What's going to come out is a random walk. So one way of getting at random walk statistics is to say, well, look, suppose I've got here already. Let me add just a little extra chain, n, and that's going to wander around in a little volume of space, localized to the end of the big one, little dn, and that's going to give me a little delta r. And I can calculate the probability of propagating from here to here by doing it from here to here, and then asking how many different ways my last little step can carry me to my new point. And I get a differential equation, which I'm going to motivate equations in an hour. I'm not going to derive them. I think that's the usual style here, right? So
if we write down the equation, what is it that's actually walking
with propagating? Oh, yes, thank you. This could be a walker in time, but in this case, it's a spatial embodiment of a random walk, which is the polymer or macromolecule. So I'm supposing that my path is there in space, and it's the polymer. So I'm supposing I'm adding another piece to the end of my polymer.
It's growth
of a chain. Okay. So I'm going to imagine. So I'm going to construct this object by growing it. Okay. So if I add another little piece to it, that's going to be propagated by the distribution over a little element length, getting it a bit further. And well, if I have a fundamental step length of b, I can show that this propagates with the Laplacian. Like so.
For the moment, could you lower the top piece of the projector? The
oh, I'm sorry, you didn't need it yet. Would this be for a couple of pickies? Yeah, fine. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, you know, this comes from an expansion of this propagator to first order in the new little piece and to second order in the new little piece. The first order piece isn't going to get me anywhere because I'm just as likely to walk a little bit further this end of the room as that end of the room. The second order piece is going to give me something, and that's going to couple to the second derivative of this propagator. This is no surprise because I also said this could be a diffusion equation in time. So what I've done is written a diffusion equation in the length of a string. Could equally well be a diffusion equation in time. This would be a step length in unit time, and I know I will get the diffusion operator, but let's think of it that way. But it's also a Schrodinger equation under a Wick rotation. Okay, I mean, this could be, and this could be the momentum. And so if I know the answer for the Schrodinger propagator, which I might not, but some of the other people here might, then you can, by the Wick rotation, rotate the solution back, and that's the diffusion propagator anyway. We know the answer to this. It's just a Gaussian. So the diffusion of density spreads as a Gaussian in space, and I can even remember the prefactors, I think. And there's a normalization factor here which goes like n to the 3/2, and I doubt worry much whether I can do that, but you never know. N b squared. So it propagates with this Gaussian, which is just like, you know, which is just like the free particle. You put an I back in here, it's the spin zero free particle propagator.
This is the capital N. What is the spin?
This is the capital N. What I've got N capital N steps in the whole. I've written here capital N steps in the whole walk, or if you like, that's my total time in the spatial walk. So I sort of know this answer.
Little b
was the step. Little b is a step length that I do have to specify. It's a length over which it's uncorrelated, right? In fact, you might say, well, hang on, you just told me that that the small length cutoff wasn't important. The point is, b can be any length over which it's uncorrelated, but I just want to make, but I can, so I can choose a b and choose an n, but I have to keep it so that this thing is constant, because that turns out to be the average end-to-end distance of my walk. So I can have larger b's, providing I have fewer of them. And under that renormalization of the problem, the structure is identical. What I can't do is to take b so small that it begins to see different physics on a smaller length scale. I want to remind you one other way of asking the question, however, because if I go back to my first picture, from which you derived this differential equation for the propagator, simply calling it a propagator reminds you that there's another way of writing this. I know what a propagator is. It's a path integral, yes? It's a sum, a weighted sum, of all possible paths. Let's change color here. Because I didn't ask what path it was. All I asked is that there's a path beginning here and ending here. And we're very familiar with an amplitude sum of paths that do this. That's not a very likely one, okay? But it's in the sum. There are more likely ones which cluster around this guy. So I know, because Feynman told us how, that I can write g of I in a completely different way. I can write it as a path integral. Let's have little r of n, actually, is the path, because I've just said big R is the end-to-end vector. And I want little r at 0 to start at the origin. I want little r at the end of the chain to be my big R. And I want to integrate over all paths. Now, there is a weight that occurs in this path. It's the action. But of course, in this case, the action in the polymer problem turns out to be the minimal constraint for connectivity. It's quadratic action in the energy. The energy is dr by dn squared. It's the kinetic energy. So we know it's going to be dr by dn squared from the quantum analogy, if we already know that one. We should get it from here, actually. And there are some prefactors, but as you might imagine. But that's the measure that ensures connectivity and nothing else. There's no correlation of vectors along this chain. But we also know that this is the path integral for which this is the answer. And we're perhaps familiar with it being the path integral that corresponds to this Schrodinger equation. Okay. And typically, the first way we try to solve path integrals is to write down the corresponding partial differential equation and solve that. So there's a sort of magic triangle of methods here, which many of you will be familiar with. So the polymers are path integrals, they're embedded path integrals. This is another example of this isomorphism between some statistical mechanical systems and some quantum mechanical ones via Rick rotation. And the reason for that is that both are typically sums over paths. In the quantum case, you sum over paths and over a complex action. In the polymer case, to calculate the statistical mechanics partition function, remember from your statistical mechanics days, we're always calculating this object, right, which is a sum over states, e to the minus the energy of the state. Yeah, I mean, beta, right? That's a sum of the states. When our systems are polymers, the partition function sum of the states becomes a sum of the parts, because what a state of this particular object is just a path. That's how the analogy occurs. The difference is, of course, in the time. In the quantum particle case, the ordinate is time, and we're proceeding through time. In the statistical mechanical case, we know it's imaginary time. People are often asking, what is the imaginary time? In the polymer case, the imaginary time is the chemical distance along the polymer. That's a way of thinking about imaginary time. So Brownian strings in statistical mechanics are particles in imaginary time. And we can watch the path integral. I want you to do me a huge favor and hold this end. So the reason I had to describe this is, of course, it's what gives me the path integral? Well, the answer is Brownian motion gives me the path integral by doing this. And you can see. You see this thing fluctuating over them around the most probable paths? Very occasional large excursions, but mostly it's doing the Feynman thing, okay? And that's it. If I loosen it up a bit, it gets a bit more quantum mechanical, you see, when the end-to-end vector is a bit less, and it gets a little bit more classical when the end-to-end vector is a bit large. Yeah? Okay? There's something else that happens, which is that I won't let go, but I'm prepared to, I've signed the insurance forms. If you let go, anytime you like, just let go. Okay, just springs towards me, okay? Now, why does it spring towards me? Well, clearly it's just random. I mean, I'm giving as many pushes as pulls, okay? So it just happened to kick me that time. Next time it's going to kick him, obviously, right? Because I'm pushing as much as pulling. Okay, let go again. Done, did it again. Why is it doing this? Why is it doing this? It's as if it's a sort of spring. It's not a spring, it's the floppiest object in the universe. Look, completely flexible polymers are totally floppy. They're the most floppy things you can imagine. But floppy strings plus Brownian motion are not floppy, they're stiff. Well, they're springy. Okay, I mean, I can even lift it off the ground in a sec, see? Against gravity. There you go. Now, okay, what you just witnessed is elementary school version of the statistical mechanics of rubber elasticity, which I think is a beautiful, beautiful thing I just remind you of. What did we just calculate? We calculate this propagator. This propagator is the sum of the path integral, so it must be a partition function. It must be the partition function of the thing, starting here and finishing there. Great, so this is actually darn it. Now, Peter Olmsted already, I won't discuss this because Peter Olmsted already gave us an extended eulogy on the difference in Z and Z during his Blackboard talk, so I'm not sure. But we know that I can calculate the free energy by just doing this. Remember statistical mechanics, I take the logarithm of the propagator and the KT gives me the free energy, which I can do because it was pre-exponentiated, so let's just do it. Minus, blah, 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 I can change the time, this to a plus 3 over 2, I say, give me a KT, I've got something to do with the polymer, NB squared, and a big R squared. Yep, so here's the propagator, seen as a partition function, gives me a free energy, which is quadratic in the end-to-end displacement, and I think some of us may have come across years ago some physics of what happens when I have an energy that's quadratic in a mode displacement. So Mr. Robert Hooke first came across this object. This is a Hookean spring. Okay. So the floppiest objects in the world plus Brownian motion become, and partition functions and path integrals and all that become the simplest things you can imagine, the simplest harmonic oscillators you can think of. And they're Gaussian springs. Of course, that's the fine-grained version of this free energy is the thing that's sitting up here. That's a little Gaussian spring over a tiny piece of the walk, which is ensuring its Brownian motion. And that's rubber elasticity. Why is it rubber elasticity? I just need df by dr, which is the force, is going to be linear in the displacement. ut extensio sic vis, said the aforementioned Mr. Hooke. So we've got Gaussian springs. Let me just tell you where else we might have Gaussian springs. You might recall that...
You didn't tell us what temperature is in your little experiment that you just did.
Oh!
When you were jiggling.
That's an exercise for the reader. Yeah, it's a kind of pseudo-temperature.
Right.
But of course, and I'm not, you know, one would have to argue a little bit. In fact, you'd have to prove that the dynamics of this thing plus the jiggles of my hand gave was ergodic in this system, blah, blah, blah. But it was the kinetic energy. Well, if we just sit here long, why don't we prove it together by just doing this all afternoon? And if we attach a little force meter to this, by the way, we could probably prove it for this system because you get this if it's ergodic, and any errors from that come from non. Oh, we'll see about that. What should we do next? What was I going to do next? Oh yes, the other work apart from before Uric people arrived, the other workshop was solar physicists. And they were interested in the magnetic field of the various layers of the sun, convection zones, sunspots, bubbling and breaking of loops, and it was all very exciting. And they had a number of mini conferences and poster sessions. And I remember once coming across, dropped in for a cup of tea, as we are supposed to do, and looked at some of their posters, and it was all very interesting. And on one of their posters was a sort of picture that looked a bit like... Actually, I'll show you the picture. It looked a bit like this. Sorry, it's come out a bit dark. It's much better on the web, but... Yeah. Actually, it looks terrible there. But it looks much better on the poster. Anyway, it was a box full of stringy stuff. Okay? See, box full of stringy stuff? And I said, yeah, it's a pretty picture. You know, it almost could have come from one of our posters. Box full of stringy stuff, we do macromolecule. Oh, what's polymer physics? That sounds interesting. What are these objects, I said? Oh, they're thin magnetic flux tubes. Quoth Dana Longcope and George Fisher, who are the organizers of the program. Oh, tell me about thin magnetic flux tubes.
What's the length scale?
Oh, anything you like. Probably, I don't know. God, I mean, how big's a sunspot? Yeah, 10,000 kilometers. 10,000 kilometers. Yeah, they hang around underneath sunspots. So what do they have? No one knows why, incidentally. At Reynolds numbers of 10 to the 12, which is on the sun, the magnetic field becomes inhomogeneous. No one knows why that is. And in fact, their community is split between the people whose simulations never go inhomogeneous, so don't believe in thin flux tubes, which are the inhomogeneous, you know, it's magnetic field that's coming together and bunching into little tube-like regions of space, and outside of which there's no field. However, no one can do a simulation, I understand, of the solar turbulent zone at Reynolds numbers higher than about 10 to the 6. The real Reynolds number is 10 to the 12. And you know, we're all aware that as you go up, it shouldn't happen. I mean, there should be just small Reynolds numbers and large Reynolds numbers, but not in fluid dynamics. You know, every decade gives you more richness in behavior, who knows why. So 10 to the 12 is 6 decades away from anyone's supposed to simulate, except you can look at the sun, you know, which costs polaroids and clever stuff. You can see where the magnetic field is, and so the other half of the field say, we've seen them, well, we know they're in these things exist, because you can see them popping out of the sun and going back again. So let's just calculate on the assumption that they exist. Well, let's actually think about a magnetic flux tube in an incompressible medium. We know what the energy of this thing is. It's the integral over the volume of the tube of B squared. Now, depending upon where you were at high school, you either want a mu naught down there or two, or you. That's what I had, but we got into terrible problems with our mu naughts. One of these guys works in a strange combination of units, which apparently Dana Long from Montana, which he is the only defender in the entire world. In which, you know, magnetic field is measured in the number of hamburgers. But it allows him to forget all constants of any dimension whatsoever. But bear with me. What is this? This is B squared. What is phi? Now, what's constant is the flux, okay? It is phi, but B is phi. Let's give this flux tube a little width, W. This is phi over W all squared, W squared, sorry. It's phi over area. Area is W squared. B squared is phi over w squared, all squared. dv, okay, let's just do the dv, is just w squared times l, all right? This, if I've done it properly, looks like phi squared, which is conserved, l over w squared, right? But this flux tube in the embedded in the medium is undergoing incompressible fluid dynamics. You have to take their word for it on the important timescales. And of course, incompressible fluids means that LW squared is the fixed volume of the flux tube, which ain't going to change as you let's put W downstairs. This gives us V and another L squared. Right, okay, got it? Energy goes as L squared. So a little flux tube embedded in the incompressible medium is a little Hookean spring driven by its magnetic energy. It turned out that it was rather better than that, because the turbulence in the bit of the sun where these things exist is not a particularly scaling turbulence. It's dominated by one particular length scale. There's a convective cell size, which is typically rather smaller than the length that the longest strings grow. Okay, there's a little turbulent length scale LT and a turbulent velocity VT, which is kicking these things around. And it's uncorrelated noise. Now, Hookean springs plus uncorrelated noise is enough at the level at least of correlations, second order correlation of these objects, to map the problem almost exactly onto a polymer problem. The only other thing you might worry about is the fact that this is the drag term. This is under huge high Reynolds number turbulence, and but there's a, when we're doing dynamics here, we need to have some form of local drag. The drag force on the flux tube is actually, you know, coefficient of drag proportional, not in linear response, as we're used to, but to the quadratically to the difference of the local velocity of the tube through the medium, V tube minus V medium squared, and that's a vector in the, okay, it's vectorial, of course, in this difference divided by the, okay, this is just a unit vector. Okay. It's that, when we put one of our little polymers in a solution, our drag is not linear. It's not quadratic, it's linear. We'll write down the dynamic equation just a little. But everything's in linear response, not non-linear response. But the point is the correlation of this medium noise is very short-lived. And if you have a slowly moving flux tube, slow relative to the turbulent medium, moving through a turbulent medium that's got a large mean but a short correlation time, you can average over the high frequency local fluctuations of the velocity and get an effective linear drag, which just looks like minus CD V tube minus vector, and then it's with the modulus of the medium velocity like that. So you can this problem of solar flux tubes becomes entirely equivalent to the dynamic version of what happens to strings. Now we're going to try and follow the dynamics of these little strings and ask, well, if this is the simplest static emergent renormalized picture of a string, what might be the simplest dynamic version? Well, here we have our path, R.
And so far you just have a very dilute.
Right. Thank you, David. Yes, we're going to, absolutely. So at the moment, this is a single particle. We're going to do many particles in 3 minutes. Okay. Absolutely, it's very dilute. So this is the trajectory. And what I want to show is that what will happen locally, well, locally, if there's a bit of curvature on here, at a coarse-grained level, means that I can talk about the curvature of this path, d2r by dn squared, which is really just the local difference in the gradients. The gradients are giving me my elastic tension, and that's pulling this little piece this way against a drag which is proportional to the velocity through the background medium, whatever that is. So if I have a drag constant times the velocity dr by dt at position n, t on the walk, I just can just balance that by the derivative of the tension, which sets up this second derivative, which looks like a curvature on the string. And then I need to excite that, because this is a emergent property. I've got coarse-grained variables, and underneath is a turbulent sea of Brownian motion. That, just like the random turbulence here, gets popped into a stochastic term. It's called a Langevin equation. And this equation is the simplest Langevin equation we can write down for a Brownian stochastic string with entropic local free energy there, local drag here against the background, and a noise which will have zero mean, and time local correlations, but the correlations are such as to give me always, but what I have to insist is that correlations be back in equilibrium distribution at large enough length scale. So fnt, fn primed, t primed looks like kt times the friction. That's the fluctuation dissipation theorem. But it's only locally correlated along the chain, and it's locally correlated in time to delta functions.
I'd like to ask you a question, which may be orthogonal to your talk. As I understand it, part of your programming is application of biophysics, right?
Yes.
In this field. Would that be in a different regime if you were to apply biophysics to the solar physics
No,
regime?
I was going...
The media would be fluctuating very slowly compared to the polymer.
The answer is, it all depends. My third example was going to be DNA. I've got saying to tell them about DNA, it says here. Typically no, because in fact, for biopolymer it's even better, because the bigger and bulkier your local polymer is, the greater is the renormalization between that and the atomic molecular scale of a solvent. And this coarse-grained picture works better and better in a colloidal, the more colloidal your local units get, the bigger separated you are in the length scales and time scales of the seething background of fluid and the objects moving around you're in. You get into trouble, actually, if you're dealing with a string which is not that much bigger than the solvent it's in. Some other example, I said it's a common motif in nature. David's already alerted us to the point where we might expect trouble if we start filling a box with these things and they overlap.
Another basic problem you have, though, maybe what you're thinking of has to do with active processes which are not thermal.
Oh, yeah, right, okay. Yeah.
That certainly changes.
So in biology, typically some of these polymers are being driven against each other by motors that are doing work and using energy creating entropy and all that. So that's very interesting. And part of our program is to look at the non-Brownian aspects of driven systems in biomolecules. And that Tanny Liverpool has been doing some very nice work on driven actin networks, where when the actin molecules cross each other, instead of just bumping into each other and letting Brownian motion do the work, there's a little myosin motor there which pushes one deterministically in one direction. And it turns out those things, for example, fluidize the system by orders of magnitude. So, yeah, there can be big differences. Is that okay? Right. So, at any rate, this equation was first written down by Mr. Rouse in 1942. By the end of the conversation with the solar guys, went, well, just write us down. Write us down the equation, the dynamical equation you think a thin solar magnetic flux tube obeys. So they wrote down this equation. apart from the noise, because it wasn't like this, because if you're a solar physicist, you typically haven't done a grad course in stat mech and know about Langevin terms. It's very easy. I mean, any more than I knew anything about anything at all about MHD. So we had a few fun days teaching each other about MHD and stochastic differential equations, and just decided they'd written down precisely the same thing. I have to say, what really impressed me is that without this machinery, we know how to solve this. We solve this the same way you'd solve it. I mean, this is a string. It's a differential equation on a string. You solve with normal modes on a string. What the normal modes look like, you know, there's, depending on the boundary conditions, there's this one, and there's this one, and there's this one, yep. And they're all there, and they contribute to the dynamics of the string as a whole. There's a whole range of timescales over which these are fast, this one's slow, and the slowest time of the ring, the slowest time the string goes actually is the square of the length of the string. You can see that from more or less t and n squared here. That's the dispersion relation. They'd just written down the equilibrium size that these strings grow to in a particular turbulent background until the tension generated by the turbulence is matched on average by the collapse tension of the Hookean spring in the tubes. And I read the paper and it was really screwy. I mean, they talked about they were averaging the curvature tension and the velocity here. And I said, no, let's just map the whole thing onto the problem. Use our machinery that we know how to do in polymer physics for half a century and get the answer. And of course, I got a different answer. And I said, I'm sorry, you know, it turned out that we had some different answer. But Dana Longcope is a lovely guy, and he checked through my algebra carefully, and you'll all know, well, some of you know what my algebra is like. And you won't be surprised to find he found a little error. So, just check the error. It's exactly the same. And I was really impressed. And so they've actually taught me new ways of thinking about that equation from their ab initio encountering of solar flux tubes that meshes with a sort of formalism of this approach, which is, it's always lovely when that happens in physics.
Sorry, Tom. In that case, though, what about fluctuation dissipation and whether temperature is the right thing
okay.
and so on?
Yep. Yeah. No, I'm not going to talk anything to say that. I think I said it already. I said all you need is for the turbulence to be uncorrelated and the timescale of the turbulence to be much less than the timescale of your polymer. And that's enough to write down a Rouse equation. Now, whether a Rouse equation is enough to ensure ergodicity and the existence of a temperature, I don't know. But once I can write a Rouse equation and believe it, I don't mind. But it is, however, I'd like to explore whether there are higher moments that behave in non-ergodic wave.
But in their case, this is a definition of the temperature. You say there's uncorrelated noise.
Yeah. Oh, so what goes here? What I tend to do is kill the drag, bring it down here. Then this becomes a random velocity. Okay. And you know how to write down the correlator for that, because this will be the square of the turbulent velocity, and to get the dimensions of the delta functions right, I need to put in the length of the turbulence and the timescale of the turbulence. Okay, and that's how you do it. And that's your coarse grained model of the thing in a turbulent background. And
yeah, the more fundamental fluctuation dissipation is just the static correlation that goes in front. You really don't even need a temperature.
No, these only become equilibrium with a pseudo temperature when these strings have expanded to the equilibrium contour length. That is a difference. That is a real difference. In the chemical polymer, the chemistry is hardwired how long they are. But in the case of an expanding flux tube, there's no hardwiring of the length. We just saw we could, you know, this is in the polymer case. This length is end to end. Vector. This is a local length which I can change. So the pseudo temperature only kicks in when there's sort of expansion phase. The only little thing blows up until it's grown enough tension to contain the kicks of the turbulence. Then there's a pseudo temperature, but not before. Actually, let me just press on because it would be fun just to look at a few problems in many chain systems. Well, before the many chain systems, let me just remind you of one thing. You might object to my rhetorical description of the single chain system, which is that a polymer in three-dimensional space can't actually be a random walk, can it? Because real-time-dependent random walks can do this, and this one can't exist in the same point of space. Now, you might think this isn't going to be much of a problem to us. There's an awful lot of space, and this is a very rarefied string. But when you do the perturbation expansion, you find you're in bad shape. Because you've got, what you mustn't do is overlap monomers here. And it was Sam Edwards who first wrote down the Hamiltonian you need to describe that. So you have this that says it's a continuous walk, and this which says you wait against any monomer n coming into contact with any other aspect, monomer n primed. Like that. Yeah, it's called the Edwards Hamiltonian. People had fun with that in the 60s and 70s. Obviously, what could you do? You could do a perturbation expansion of this thing, and you find that it isn't, it doesn't converge. It's in three dimensions, it doesn't converge. It's a perturbation expansion which has an upper critical dimension of 4. So you can attack this different ways. What can you do? You can either go into 4 dimensions, do renormalization group calculation, do it, end it with an epsilon expansion, and that's fine. And with epsilon is -1, back to 3. Fortunately, I think it goes as epsilon over 8, so that you might be okay there. Or you could do simulations, just big for simulations, and throw out chains which cross each other. Or you can cross your fingers behind your back, shut your eyes, and do a mean field calculation, which is the Flory calculation, which is a lovely one, and gets absolutely right for coincidental reasons. At the end of all that, you find that the end-to-end vector squared doesn't go as n to the half, it goes to it does scale, nothing breaks the scale invariance, but this is not, this exponent nu is not a half, it's a half for perfect random walks, and it's about 2 nu. It's about 3/5 for self-excluding random walks. The general dimension, I'm going to get this wrong if I just try and write it down. Who remembers the Fourier result? In d dimensions, this thing is actually 3d over d plus 2, which embodies the fact that this is the upper critical dimension is 4, because in 4 dimensions this is the mean field thing. This is the entire mean field thing, and this gives a half in 4 dimensions. No, it doesn't. I knew I'd regret doing this. Exercise the reader. Calculate the mean field inverse. Oh, that's better. Oh, well. I'll think about this later. So I have to tell you about one more miracle. So this is a more expanded. It's a more expanded object. So we've had a few miracles already. We've had this difficult, complicated chemical system. We've had emergent, renormalizable physics, which is emergent, which has very few parameters, or at least all the molecular physics gets coarse-grained, note, in a few parameters like a step length and a drag. We have one more miracle, which is David's request that we start sticking loads of these in a box. Let's put a lot of these things in a box and then ask what happens. Well, what happens here is that, you see, the perturbation expansion of this thing, well, I can do this in Feynman diagrams, if you like. So the propagator for this object with this Hamiltonian is a sum of the bare propagator, you see, plus a one-loop self-exclusion, right, plus, and 2 diagrams for that one. It's self-excluding at 2 points, plus, 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 plus. So you, all the diagrammatics works in this field rather nicely with a nice little twist that in the field theory for polymers, the Feynman diagrams are the polymers. So every little Feynman diagram you might like to draw is a polymer intersecting itself or someone else. If I do this in the many chain case, I'd want to add, and this is a single chain propagator, I add a whole set. So these diagrams are all responsible for this change of exponent. In the many chain case, I've got a bunch of other interactions, which is the chain interacting with another chain, like this, with a little weight, omega to the half, w to the half, plus the chain interacting with another chain, which interacts with itself, and so forth, and so forth, and so forth. So I have a whole set of diagrams, which is a chain interacting with other chains that then interact back on it, plus the self interaction diagrams. A really surprising thing is that those two sets of diagrams perfectly cancel. Well, not perfectly cancel. They just add a little renormalization to the bare propagator. In other words, or at low Q, at low energy, all that happens is that the chains go Gaussian again because of the balance between their own excluded volume and the, which is, if you like, an internal pressure, and the compressive pressure, if you like, of excluded volume with the other chains around it, which in its own absence would have left a little hole, you see, and are pressing into that little hole. Alternatively, now why does this happen? Okay, why does this happen? So just imagine a pot of seething spaghetti, and you're a, you know, you're involved, you're a piece of spaghetti, and you're involved in this orgy of spaghetti, in Brownian motion, squirming over each other, and you're in this orgy, and so you come across a leg, okay, and you have this leg, pile of heaving flesh, you come across this, you know, this, it started with spaghetti, the illustration has changed somewhat. So you come across a leg, and the point is, you don't know if it's your leg or anyone else's leg. If you're on your own, you know it's your leg, okay? But if you're in this pile of seething, you don't know whose leg it is. So, I mean, should you avoid it because it's yours, or should you, or, you know, Should you go away from it because it's yours, or you know, should you not tear yourself away? I mean, you give up. I don't know whose leg it is. I just do what I'm going to do, and that's what these chains do. They just do gas in random walks because they can't be bothered to do the path integrals. Who can? And I mean, if I can't do the path integrals, why should the chains do the path integrals? So they just decide to be Gaussian. And it's just wonderful. You can see why. It's just God's gift. It means that, you know, people like me can even do this stuff.
Why isn't they stick together to make a polyethylene bag?
Those are other interactions. Those are real. All these are just excluded. All this is entropy so far. I've just told you about entropy. So I'm in the high temperature limit where energy doesn't matter. Yeah, if I cool it down, they stick.
That's a statement about the n equals zero theory. I mean, what is the statement of field theory about here? You're saying that this is like an interacting.
This is like interacting.
I mean, what?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you go about proving it?
The result is concentration independent?
Well, not quite, because the concentration sets you the length scale at which it works. So let me draw you. Okay, this will make it clear for you. Let me draw you the length scale, which I'm going to call C because it really is a correlation length.
Right.
It's the length scale over which the local density is dominated. It will be changed between the local density being dominated by one string and the local density being dominated by many strings. And for higher Q, lower, smaller length scales than this guy, self-interaction, sums don't work, self-excluded volume, we have this exponent. But for larger length scales, the cancellation sets in and the things are Gaussian. So if I change the concentration, the way I get from this limit to this one is by bringing in the Gaussian physics at longer and longer length scales. As I concentrate down, it invades the whole system. Okay, so that's what's going to happen.
Question?
Matthew.
You're implicitly allowing the chains to pass through one another.
At the moment, I am, yes. Okay.
They wouldn't.
So let's stop them doing that now. Is that a good idea? That's a good idea, isn't it?
But how do you prove this?
You can do this in other ways. There are various people who have done selective sums of diagrams.
What do you mean select? Sorry, who selects?
I think they were probably talking about experiments. It's both. Okay. There are theorems at various levels of rigor. You can also check this experimentally by neutron scattering, as David says. So, for example, what you can do is to replace hydrogenated versions of some of your strings with deuterated versions. Which have the same entropic interactions at least, and but scatter from them and check that the walks are Gaussian. It's a hard one experimental result. It's true experimentally. Though you can also do this, there are also mean field versions of this, which
I don't think there's a really rigorous mathematical proof that starts from the field theory. But
anyway. No, so I know what it was in Free Carl Fried had a good go. I think that's right. I don't think there's a. I don't know whether there's one at the level of rigor that you'd pass through with a green light, but seems to work. Okay, let's just do dynamics in this case, because Matthew was worried that when I start packing these things, just when it's excluded volume, which would be there, however ergodic my system was, there's a topological problem. Okay, and this is the bit that we've been talking about the last couple of weeks rather intensively. what happens to the dynamics of these string-like objects when they're strongly overlapped and topologically constrained not to pass through each other? And this is really extraordinary. Let's see what we might guess might happen, actually. Let's see what we might guess might happen. There's some length scale. Just as there's some length scale over which the static correlations are single particle, you might expect the dynamic correlations also to be single particle local. So I call this high Q asymptotic freedom. Right? But you might expect that if this string starts wandering further through, tries to wander further through space, it's going to topologically bump into others, and it's going to be hindered. So this is the array of obstacles picture. Let's just draw a kind of cartoon of that. So there's a little array of obstacles which are other chains passing through the board, which this thing is going to have to encounter. And those things pass through themselves, so very soon, attempted lateral displacement of this object is going to encounter an increasingly large bunch of constraints. You're going to slow it down. So it's going to behave as if it were in a sort of tube. And this is the mean field picture suggested by originally Sam Edwards in 1967 to approach the role of topology in elastic networks, but by De Gennes in the dynamical sense, first of all in 1972. So there's a range in which this object has local freedom, and then it starts hitting these constraints. And beyond that, motions sort of parallel to this tube-like region is going to be constrained, but there's a mode that isn't, which is the spaghetti mode. When you eat spaghetti, you dig your fork in, you wind it up, and you don't get stuff all down your front. If you wind the spaghetti, and you can see the thing snaking out of their constraints onto your fork. You see, that's the way to do it carefully. If only our children would. Never mind. So the Browning motion will do this as well. And Browning motion will eventually untie this thing, and it'll diffuse a bit this way, diffuse a bit that way. It'll explore new constraints, but the point is it'll be able to become ergodic again over on time scales now, which is the diffusion times of this thing out of its tube-like region. Now, remember that the free string had a longest relaxation time which went as the square of its molecular weight. This guy is going to have to diffuse a distance L, which is this length of the tube, against a drag, which is also proportional to its length, because the longer I make it, the more monomers it has, the more drag it has. These are both proportional to the number of monomers it contains. So the role of topology, at least for these linear objects, is going to dynamically extend the longest relaxation time to equilibrium, okay, from n squared to n cubed. Now, it turns out we can do better than that. And we can, how do we might measure this? Well, one of the lovely things about this field is the availability of data on clean systems. Now, what you wouldn't want to do is to do experiments on your plastic bag in the oven, because there's all goodness knows what's in there. But what chemists can do, and have been able to do for many years now, is to use a technique called anionic polymerization, which gives them very, very monodisperse known weight lengths of polymers in large quantities, several grams. And they can make linear flexible strings. They can make mixtures of small ones and large ones. They can even make these guys. Now that would be fun, wouldn't it? Because why would that be fun? The reason that would be really fun is because we've just decided that the dominating physics at the longest time scales, which are actually the ones that control viscosity of melts, it's kind of nice. One day in the week you can be doing field theory in this field, and next day in the week you can be off with BP Chemicals or something talking about chemical engineering and how you pump more polyethylene through hot polyethylene through little tubes, and it's the same. I mean, it's a very nice field to work with if you enjoy meeting different people who think in completely different ways. And some of them make branched objects as well. So that would be fun to do. And you can even do have Feynman diagram polymers, which happen to be my favorite. And Jacques Rubers, a Canadian, was the first to synthesize these back in the early 80s from polystyrene. Wonderful. I mean, every molecule looks like this, and you can tell things.
What does the microchemistry what does it do at the cubic vertex? The chemistry, the carbon?
Oh, what you use at the cubic vertex, this one, what you
branch,
how does it branch? What you do, it's what you do is you independently synthesize this bit, this part, and this part, and you end up with little polymers with a little double bond on the end.
Okay.
You throw in an enormous excess of these objects as a carbon with three chlorines on. Trichloro-silane. And, silane, sorry. Silane, so you have to use silane chemistry. Silicon with three chlorines, or have as many chlorines as you want to put branches on. These things couple to those. Well, this one's a bit trickier, you can imagine. But the glassware is fabulous. In fact, I have the sort of theorem that you could have different pots for your arms and a pot for the backbone. If you want to make things with three arms, you have different pots which you open the taps from at different times. So there's a sort of theorem which relates the topology of the glassware you need to make this thing to the topology of the molecule, which I haven't actually worked out, but would be a great fun exercise for.
So with silicon, you can make new life forms, and you can make
parts. You could make branched DNA with silicon. Yes, you could. Yes, you could. Okay. Now you can do an elasticity experiment on this, and I thought let's probe this. There are about 10 experimental methods now available to this community for studying these well-defined materials. The simplest one is what's partially known as mechanical spectroscopy. It means basically just hit it and see what it does, wiggle it and see what it does, or rheology. But there's light scattering. I mentioned neutron scattering. Hiroshi Watanabe was telling us last week about the use of dielectric spectroscopy on well-synthesized materials that have little electric dipoles along their backbone, which probe the dynamics with a different moment to the stress one. Anyway, a whole gamut of different techniques now, which pins the theoreticians down. Because there's plenty of theories out there which agree with the mechanical spectroscopy perfectly, and as soon as Hiroshi comes with the dielectrics or someone else comes with neutron scattering, yes, the whole thing falls down like a pack of cards. So back to the drawing board. Let's just see what we might expect for the elasticity of this object as a function of omega frequency. Very high frequency. I said we should have asymptotic freedom. Okay? And that was this free Rouse. It turns out the spectrum goes this frequency to the half. And then at medium frequencies, when I'm reaching the tube-like region, I start getting constrained. And I don't move anywhere for a long, long time. So I'd expect the elasticity to have a sort of plateau from this length scale, it's tau E of hitting an entanglement, to the longest time scale to disengage from the tube. And then things are going to turn into a fluid.
One over tau,
thank you. Yeah. So, and I might expect this plateau region here to get longer and longer and longer as I ask my chemist to synthesize longer and longer molecular weights. So I'm going to just show you a little bit of data now. This is, ignore the lower three curves, but the upper three curves are just that elasticity. The lower one is actually the dissipation spectrum, but the elastic spectrum, actually I've just cut off the asymptotic bit here. This looks like frequency to the quarter. This is high energy asymptotic freedom. Then nothing much happens for a range of time scales, and then the thing goes liquid. And here are three molecular weights, a baby one, a baby bear, a medium-sized bear, and a great big bear. And this, the value of that elastic plateau is just a measure of the density of your constraints. So that's some idea, some measure of the size of the tube-like region, which is dominating the topology. And one of our mysteries we've been grappling with is what gives the size of that region? Because it is not the distance to the molecule next door. Let me take all the solvent away until there's a melt and the polymer strings are bumping right up against each other at a density that locally looks like that in my fist, and ask what this level of response is telling me about the size of the tube. And although the distance from one molecule to another is about one angstrom, the distance across the tube is of the order of 10 to the 2 angstroms. 10 nanometers, yes.
10 times.
100 times larger. And that's one of our great, actually it's God's gifts. It's a God's gift to us. Because if it weren't, we'd be in trouble. It's only because it's so large that we can employ already coarse-grained theories inside the tube. We'd be in deep trouble if we couldn't do that. Why it's so large? Well, why might it be so? Well, I think I'm not going to do that because I'm just going to tell you about the topology. If you're interested in discussing that, you know, people have had great fun with topological invariance. There are simulations. It's something to do with the fact that these entanglements are not two-body interactions. You can ask yourself the question, how I can take lots of different chemistries of polymer, and I can measure the size of this tube-like region for each one, styrene, and really fancy polymers with big dangling side groups. And Lou Fetters, who would have been here this week, has done all this. Had a bit of a story with Lou Fetters and US Air, I'm afraid. But and you can ask, well, for each one, how many other chains, Mr. Polymer, do you require in your tube-like volume to notch up one of these lengths? One effective entanglement or one effective topological constraint. And the surprising answer that every single chemistry gives you back the same answer. It's 20. Not 42, I'm afraid. It's 20. So every polymer we know about needs 20 other chains in its topological unit volume, which is, if the tube-like constraint is A, so in a volume of A cubed, there are 20 other chains. And that's a universal law, and we simply don't understand it.
Otherwise, it can squeeze out.
Its own lateral diffusion isn't that quick, actually. It's actually sub-Fickian. So if I asked how far in unit time this thing would go sideways anyway, r squared perpendicular turns out not to go like t, but like t to the half. So r going t to the quarter, because it's dragging more and more things with it. So you might expect this to be quite soft. We'll leave that one.
This problem is very similar to the kind of things that people who do protein folding encounter, right?
Yes. And we
have interaction with those.
Yes, I have. In fact, Kevin Platzko and I have a preprint just coming out now from when we started working together in January.
Whole theory is based on this.
Topomers, exactly. Yes, there is, and it's a wonderful insight. And I think it's almost exactly half the story. There's another half, but yes. The Santa Barbara flavored UCSB version of protein folding is that topological states matter, and I like it very much indeed. And it's something that.
Do they also encounter this factor 100? Or he just models it?
No, it's not. There's not a tube in there. It's a slightly different version of topology without this length scale. It's really, is this alpha helix above or below that alpha helix? And you're only going to get to the Brownian, to the ground state if it's around the back of the alpha helix, then it's going to take a long way to get around the front. But of course, underneath this, are constraints precisely of that nature. What we have difficulty with in the case of flexible polymers is trying to calculate this. And so Dave Morse here has calculated it in the case of stiff polymers, which there's a whole other class of objects which are not ultra floppy at the high length scale, but whose propagators are that at that length scale. And if you overleave sticks and rods, and Dave has calculated this thing. I thought I should just finish with making two points which illustrate things that we've been talking about. The other reason, of course, that these constraints might not be felt is that they're there because of other chains. They're not permanent. And if these manage to get out of the way before you have a hard time pushing through them, then they're effectively not there. Yeah. So there is a collective mode. And the collective mode is the self-consistent version of these other things getting out of the way when you're trying to get out of the way. But we've developed a rather aesthetically satisfying synthesis of the free chain and constrained chain pictures to understand this. We seem to have two clear endpoints, the type of dynamics these Brownian strings can have. One is the completely free chain, the Rouse model, I wrote you that before. And one is the totally constrained chain, the thing in a cube. Our current technology for the simplest or with the smallest number of parameters of standard model for the coupled many mode is to say that, look, these little constraints, which are describing this tube, themselves have a lifetime. In that lifetime, they can hop out of the way, and the tube can undergo a local reconfiguration like that. Well, what's the tube? The tube is a one-dimensional fat string, okay? But it's a random walk. It's a random walk that is now subject to little local excitations and hops. By fluctuation dissipation, that's equivalent to a local drag. But there ain't no constraints on the tube. The tube is a free polymer. Inside it is a constrained polymer. So our current standard model, but we actually had a question 2 weeks ago, is there a standard model of polymer topology? Our current standard model is a constrained real chain in a tube, which is itself a polymer-like object obeying the free dynamics. And it's a product expression. What we can do with that? Well, what we can do with that model is put the curves through the data here. So there is a quantitative side to this story, and these are calculations by my colleague Alexei Lichtman, who's over here, who's putting. There are a few other quantum numbers to add. You remember the old hydrogen atom, n quantum atom, and you can't quite describe the spectrum with n alone. You need m, l, and m. Okay, so we have our l and m as well, and there are other physics that go by the name of contour length fluctuation, and constraint release, which is what I've just described. How many parameters? Good question. We would like to have, okay, we're gunning for a emergent sort of model of entangled polymers at this stage with 2 free parameters for each chemistry. And those 2 free parameters are if you've seen them, just the drag per monomer, the drag per local piece of chain, and the tube size. Once we know those 2, if you think about it, we should just let the calculations run. We should know everything.
Tube size is this factor of 100.
That's the factor of 100. And the drag is something temperature dependent. You know, I can heat it up and it all speeds up. So I need to know about that. That's from the fine-grained picture. And there's this tube diameter, which is also does depend upon the chemistry, but gives us something much bigger. So what we're really hoping for is a 2-parameter theory of arbitrary topologies and arbitrary architectures. For a chain. They have 2 plus epsilon parameters.
they have 2 parameters.
Okay. Well, it's two. We've made one choice. The coupled mode. We know that for every chain in your environment that runs away, your tube should locally hop about 1 unit. But no one's got a fine-grained model enough to say whether that's 1 or 1/2 or pi to the 6 over 24. So there's an order 1 number, which is why I say it's kind of epsilon parameter. That's the size of the tube, or the dynamic size of the tube.
What quantitative does it explain this rise as you go down?
This, sorry.
Which? Rise.
Oh, sorry. The elastic curves are the 3 top ones. These turn out to be the real part of the response function. These curves are just the imaginary part of the same response function, which have a bit more detail in. So that's the first thing I want to say. The other thing I want to make one brief remark, is the higher topology, because I just can't resist it. It's a topological theory, so if we change the topology of the molecules, what's going to happen to the dynamics? And I already told you that we can change the topology to, example, this guy. So what does our theory say? It says put these asymptotically free strings in tubes, a bit like Houdini. Put Houdini in a straitjacket, throw him in the pool of hungry sharks, and ask him to get out of it. Now, if it was a linear chain, it would wiggle out of it in a time which went like n cubed. But this is Houdini. Actually, it's Houdini with an arm locked off. Oh, let me make it really Houdini. let me make Houdini with a very short torso. Now, he's in big trouble. Big trouble, okay. What's he going to do? Well, he can't squeeze himself down one tube. That would just be gruesome. So he just, you know how you get out of a straitjacket. You do this, and you pull your arms in, and because the Brownian motion will eventually allow these arms to create rare but possible unentangled loops, which brings this going back. Okay, so small fluctuations take you a little way. Deep fluctuations take you further and further and further. But the really deepest ones are now exponentially slow. Because now what's happening is that the Brownian particle, which is the chain end L, is tunneling now in an effective potential, which goes like L squared. And over n. That's the free energy of a Gaussian excursion. And so we know that the maximum time is going to go like n squared e to the n, with some prefactor there that we've argued about a very great deal. And that's what happens. Let me just show you what happens when you ask your wizard chemistry friends to synthesize for you two polymers, a linear one and a star one, that have the same, the point is the same span molecular weight. So there's the linear one, and I make the star polymer by just growing an arm off the side like that. This is the same plot that I've shown you before, and you can't see because I'm showing you the wrong bit. There we go. So just look at the upper two curves. Here's log frequency. Here's the region of asymptotic freedom. Here's the plateau. Here's the little linear polymer. Flat plateau, then it goes fluid at longer timescales. The star polymer, you get to that timescale, nothing's happened. And then very slowly, over decades and decades, decades and decades, more of it relaxes until it goes fluid here. This is consistent of little deeper and deeper parts of the arm eventually being visited for the first time by the free end and topologically disentangled from the melt. And sure enough, if you make shorter arms, this thing comes down here, and longer arms, this thing goes over here. And what will happen if we get our chemists to make the Feynman diagram polymer? If we have the Feynman diagram polymer, this is really Houdini. We dress Houdini up in a straitjacket. This is tortoise's arm. Right, now what does he do? The first thing he does is exactly what the starfish did, Houdini the starfish. Because this torso can't go anywhere, right? It's topologically pinned here and here. So you wait a long, long time till the arms have eventually had a first passage problem against an elastic entropic potential vector here. And then, what have you got? You've got enormous bits of drag here and here, and a piece of polymer which is entangled, for sure, but the only things it can be entangled with are other versions of the crossbar that are close by. Can you see why? Because long sits with much higher frequency, all the other arms in the pot are pulling themselves out and completely redistributing their local topology. So that these super slow timescales, they can't really hinder the crossbar. And you write down the math for that. Well, you see what you might get. You might get this huge shoulder from the star, then instead of going fluid, you'll get a piece of the backbone, the crossbar piece, whose topology is no longer branched. Note, the topology of these higher order things get renormalized down at lower timescales, and we'll just have a lower plateau or a peak, as a linear polymer does, and here too, made by Jürgen Allgeier in Germany in Jülich. There we go. Let's just look at the top one. Here's the elastic plateau. Here's the arm, finished there. If it were a star polymer, it turns out, it would have relaxed long ago. The relaxation time of the arms hanging on a backbone of H's are much exponentially longer than they are in just other stars, because of the extraordinary cooperativity. There's some permanent network slowing it down, and then there's the crossbar piece. So we have a theory called dynamic tube dilation that is the same two-parameter model that seems to agree with the within about 5 or 10% for every comb and H and higher topology structure anyone has ever made. The only drawback is that it's quite clear that the formulation which we had broke down 10 years ago, which is that everything that's diluted so far is a solvent, is wrong. Let's do it.
So there's an obvious prediction that you have, which might have been done.
Okay.
That is that if you synthesize Feynman diagrams
with groups, yes,
they'll never be able to relax.
Right. That's correct, and this has been done. It's actually been done in two ways. If you synthesize Feynman diagrams with loops, if you synthesize the polymers overlapping in situ, then that's exactly what happens. The topological interactions are permanent, and you make a gel. And it's got a modulus, and it's elastic, and it never flows away. There's another thing you can do, though, which is equally intriguing, which is to synthesize the rings in a dilute solution and then compress them. And Dan Michael Rubenstein has thought deeply about that over the last few years, and those squashed rings that are forced not to interact have completely different statics by scattering and much faster dynamics. That's another story, but the rings are gorgeous. So we have a conceptual problem over why this approximation works so well, and literally, I mean, for me, this is becoming clear over the last few days. It's very exciting, in my point of view. It has to do with the fact that in these highly cooperative modes, we meet with a problem of first passage over high barriers in very high dimensional spaces. Because in fact, I've got all these internal modes of the polymer trying to help me get out of this topology in very rare excursions. I also have an additional set of modes coming from the self-consistent relaxation of the topology of my field. And it's right again, we find ourselves back into a problem right at the heart of physics that's been revisited over the last half century of how activated processes behave in very high dimensional spaces, another one of which is the protein folding problem. So I think I'll stop there. We've had enough streams for now. Thanks.
Burning questions?
Yes, I have one question. Is it possible in this 500 figure for the arms to collapse and the tubes to join and then just slide out?
Yes. That's a beautiful question. And the answer is, in linear response, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But if you do go to a supermarket and go shopping, and if you do take your shopping bag, dissolve it, do a chemical analysis on it. It's made of a thing called low-density polyethylene. A low-density polyethylene have molecules which, well, actually nobody knows quite what they look like, but they look at least as nasty as this. They're really hairy, guys. Now, the reason that the industrialists use this branched stuff is because it has very, very benign properties when you process with it. Now, processing is not about slow tickling linear response. The processing is getting as much of this plastic goo from over here to over here and cool down as fast as you can to make as many plastic bags at as little cost as you can. Right? Now, if you try and make plastic bags with linear polymers, you can't. There's a beautiful process called bubble blowing. Yes. How a plastic bag is made is you have an enormous pot of hot polymer. You pump it vertically upwards through a thin ring die. So you have a cylindrical molten sheet of polymer glistening and wobbling its way up to the 50 feet high roll-up. And it takes 50 feet to cool, and it crystallizes, and it's wound up at the top, and you have and you make bags. During the flow, you're putting it up fast, you're stretching it down nice and thin. The linear polymer has the wrong rheology for that. In other words, if you stretch it out, the chains align, don't stretch, and the effective tension goes down with the stretch, and that's an instability. What you'd like is a polymer that, as you stretch it out thin, gives you a tension which rises slightly as you stretch it, and which will stabilize the formation of necks and holes. Now, what we've shown with some of these model materials is that it's the guys with two branch points or more that do this for you, because not the ones. I mean, the linear polymers don't work because you try and stretch them, you can't, because you can only pull on them with the tubes. And you can pull on my sleeve, and that sleeve will come off, but my arm won't. But if you dress this thing up and you pull on it, this bit will stretch. And this gives you, they call it strain hardening or melt strength. And you can show it only comes from molecules with a topology of this one plus some. But hang on, the viscosity of these guys is exponentially large. I'll never be able to process with it. So what you really need is a polymer that stretches these things at the rates at which the bag is being formed, but which has a much lower effective viscosity in the tiny dye region where it's being pulled through. And the reason that you can do this is because your process is what happens if you pull hard enough. if you really pull this thing, you find that the maximum stress per molecule saturates when this thing has stretched about 2 times, and after that, it does what you suggested. It pulls the whole thing in. The object becomes a linear-like object, topologically constrained like this in one tube, and it flows like water. Of course, the physicists didn't. This was invented long, long before any physicist had any idea how to write a theory for these things. But it's nice to, you know, kind of nice to know, isn't it? And one day, I mean, one day we might be useful to someone. I mean, it turns out that there's some brand new catalysts out there. You may have heard of metallocenes, or there's a huge legal blood all over the floor thing between Exxon and Dow in this country and global over new catalysts that were able to make this sort of stuff, but much more precisely. And so now, for the first time, the chemical engineers in these sort of companies are beginning to ask questions like, well, from the molecular physics we know, are there any design protocols we should be using to develop plastics which have processing characteristics at point A, point B, point C along the production chain? And the grant-giving authorities just love that stuff. So brilliant question.
Okay, let's start.